Your next speaker is Lyndall R. Doty.
The cross, the death of Jesus Christ, is the focal point of the Bible. All things lead up to it, and all things point back to it. Paul emphasized in his preaching the cross. He said, "I do not preach in the wisdom of men," and so forth, "but rather I preach the cross and glory in the cross of Christ." We sang this beautiful song just a moment ago about when I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died. It's a beautiful song. It's one of my favorite songs. For the Christian, when we survey the cross, we need to recognize that the hope for eternal life is found in the cross, isn't it? For the Christian, the gospel, the good news, is centered around the cross of Christ. When we partake of the Lord's Supper every first day of the week, we remember the cross of Christ and His death on that cross. There's no more important, perhaps, item or object or figure than that of the death of Jesus Christ on the cross of Calvary. Without the cross, there is no meaning to what we do. Without the death of the cross, there is no meaning to the gospel. There is no meaning to hope. There is no meaning to the Lord's Supper. There is no meaning to baptism. There is no meaning to the things that we engage in as Christians. The cross is the focal point of all of Christianity. Today, I want to talk with you about the cross. I want to do it from a harmony standpoint of the four Gospels, so that I'll not be quoting, per se, any individual Gospel. But we're going to be looking at the Gospel or the cross and surveying the cross from the standpoint of all four accounts to try to put them in a sequence which I think will be helpful to you as we survey the cross of Christ. The story begins as the disciples and Jesus leave the place where the Last Supper was partaken of, and they leave and go down from Jerusalem, leave the gates of the city, and go down across the valley of Hinnom, across the creek, and up into the Garden of Gethsemane. This was the place that Jesus, when He was in Jerusalem, went for prayer. The disciples knew that was a common place for Him to go, and also Judas knew as well. Jesus is in the garden, and He goes a bit apart from the main body of the disciples and calls three of the most faithful, the ones that He could rely in and trust on perhaps the most, Peter, James, and John. And He takes them a little ways into the garden and He says, "Now wait here and pray for Me and watch for Me." And He goes a few paces further on into the garden, and then He falls prone on His face and He begins to pray. The human side is pictured in the garden. For Jesus says, "Lord, if it's possible, remove this cup from Me, but Thy will be done." He goes back and He finds His disciples asleep. And He says, "What, could you not stay awake for just a little while and pray and watch for Me? I know the Spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." He goes back in again and prays with such intense emotional and psychological pressure that great drops of sweat mixed with blood dropped to the ground from His brow. There have been those who have tried to discount this and said, "Well, that's not possible. That was just a figment of Luke's imagination." But if they had bothered to check the medical records, they would have found that, in fact, there are recorded events and situations in which people have actually sweat drops of blood, in which the psychological pressure applied from the mind and so forth to the physical body have caused the capillaries and the sweat glands to break, and blood mingles with sweat, and a drop from the brow as drops of blood. Jesus was under that kind of pressure in the garden. He comes back and He finds His disciples again sleeping. He says, "Well, don't worry about it now." Because as perhaps He could hear, or perhaps see, as He turned to look down the pathway leading from the garden, there was a mob coming. Jesus spoke from the shadows and said, "Whom do you seek?" He said, "We're looking for that Jesus of Nazareth." And He simply said, "I am He." And they fell back, not knowing perhaps what He would do. Nothing happened. And so then Judas makes his way from the mob and goes to and begins to kiss him. Jesus said, "Would you betray me with a kiss, Judas?" And the mob came. The disciples are not knowing what to do. And Peter sword, and he swings his sword and cuts off the ear of Malchus, a servant of the high priest. Jesus reaches up and heals the ear of the servant. And yet the mob takes him and binds him and leads him down the way. And all his disciples then, unable to know what to do and unable to do anything, flee. Jesus is taken to Annas' house, the official high priest. He's taken to Annas, and Annas begins to question him and said, "What is it that you've been teaching? What is it that you've been doing?" And Jesus said, "Why, look, this group right here have heard me speak. If you need to know what I spoke, then ask them." And the man who was standing closest to him opened his hand and hit him in the mouth with an open hand. The first blow of many blows to be struck on Jesus. He was only there a short time. He was taken then from Annas' house to Caiaphas' house. During this period of time, Caiaphas has been calling in the Sanhedrin, the official council of the Jews. A great number of them are already there. It's late at night. Some of them have been called from their beds to come in so that their quorum could be there to actually pronounce punishment on Jesus. That was their plans. They began to accuse Jesus, and false witnesses were brought in to try to find him guilty and to try to establish some kind of legal basis for judging him and finding him guilty. But it was hard to find any of them that agreed with one another, and finally two of them were fairly close. And Caiaphas said to Jesus, "Tell us now. Go ahead, we've got these witnesses. We're going to punish you. Tell us now. Tell us the truth. I adjure you. Are you the Son of God, or are you the Christ who claims to be the Son? Are you the Christ, the Son of God?" And Jesus said, "Thou sayest. And thou shalt see the Son of God come with the clouds of heaven." Indicating not only, you don't just sit in judgment of me, it seems to me, but what he's saying is, I will sit in judgment of you. Not only am I the Christ, the Son of God, well, I will come in the clouds and I will be your judge one of these days. From that point on, Jesus is turned over to the Jewish soldiers. They began to mock him. They blindfold him. They walk by and they slap him in the face. They spit upon him, spit in his face. And they slap him and say, "Who is it, Jesus, that slapped you? Come on, you're the Son of God. You're the great Messiah. Tell us who it is that hit you." And all night long, that kind of abuse continued. Perhaps as new soldiers arrived, or new members of the council arrived, this kind of ridicule continued all night long. No sleep, no rest, continuous ridicule and buffeting around the face. You ever been hit in the mouth? Ever been hit in the nose? Ever been hit across the face? Ever have anybody spit in your face? That's the kind of abuse that Jesus was undergoing that night. It was during this period of time that Peter is outside, having followed afar off, and he's out there trying to keep his fingers warm around a little pile of coals. And there are others who are out there. The soldiers and the servants are there, and the maid servants and so forth. And some of them recognize him, and one maid says, "Oh, you're one of those Nazarenes too, aren't you?" And he says, "No, it's not me." So he goes outside a little further, and around that fire, there's another person who says, "Hey, I think your speech, you're from Galilee. Are you one of those Nazarenes? You're a follower of his." And the maid comes out and says, "Yes, that's right. You were. You're a follower." And he says, "No, no, no." And he begins to curse Jesus, denying him. And about that time, a rooster crows. And Peter remembers what Jesus said, that before the rooster crows twice, you'll deny me three times. That rooster crowed, and Peter looked up, and evidently through the porticles, Jesus turned and looked at Peter. And Peter remembered what he said, and he left that place and went off to himself, weeping as he went, sorrowful indeed that he had betrayed with a curse his Savior. The night continued. And as it continued, finally, early in the morning, enough of the council had arrived so that Jesus could officially be pronounced as guilty of blasphemy of God. The pronouncement is made, and they determined then to take him to Pilate so that Pilate might be able to give the official pronouncement of death. They already had it planned out. They knew what they were going to do. And they took him to Pilate early in the morning. They, unable because of the fact that it was the day of preparation, unable to go into a Gentile and into that Gentile house, asked Pilate to come out to the porch in order to talk with them. Pilate came out, and Jesus then is presented as one who is one who is guilty. Pilate says, "What has he done?" He said, the Jews said, "Why, if he hadn't done something, you think we'd have brought him to you? If he didn't have some kind of guilty problem, do you think we'd have brought him? Just go ahead and pronounce what we want you to pronounce. Go ahead and tell us that he's guilty and put him to death and get it over with." And Pilate says, "Well, no, I can't. What is he guilty of?" And so he takes him in and begins to question Jesus. And he says, "Jesus, are you a king? Are you a king like these Jews claim you are?" And Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. I came to be a king, rightly so. My kingdom is not of this world. Those who follow the truth follow me." And Pilate says, "What is truth?" And leaves it at that and takes him back out and says, "I find no guilt in this man. He's not worthy of death. What do you want me to do with him?" And he said, they said, "This man has been an insurrectionist. He has caused problems all the way from Galilee." And Pilate said, "Galilee, you say? Well, that's Herod's jurisdiction. And guess what? Herod's in town. Let's just send him over to Herod." So Jesus is bound again. He's led with this mob of soldiers, and then the mob of the Jews following along behind, hollering and telling him what they're going to do to him. Finally, he goes to Herod's place, his house. And Herod's been looking forward to seeing Jesus. He wants some kind of miracle performed. And he says, "Jesus, do some great thing for me here. Are you really what you claim?" And he begins to talk to him and accuse him and mock him and so forth. And finally, Jesus never says a word. And finally, Herod tires of his play, throws a crimson robe on his back and says, "Okay, King, go on back to Pilate." Jesus makes his way back to Pilate again. Pilate has the problem again. It seems to me as I study through this that Pilate wants to get rid of the problem. Pilate wants to get rid of the responsibility of killing an innocent man. But Pilate has it again. So he takes them in and he says, "Look, this man has done nothing as far as I can see. I have always, and we have a custom here, that during this time I will release a prisoner that of your choosing. Which will it be? A Barabbas who is a murdering insurrectionist? Or will it be this innocent man, Jesus, who simply claims to be a Christ? Which will it be?" He's sitting on the judgment seat and waiting for a decision on the part of the Jews. The scribes and the Pharisees and those who are so opposed to Jesus work their way through the crowds and say, "Tell him to give us Barabbas. Tell him to give us Barabbas. Let's put to death this radical Jesus. Let's get rid of this man." And they work the crowds, and the crowd is ready. Pilate's wife comes to him and says, "Pilate, don't have anything to do with this righteous man. I've been vexed in a dream tonight about him. Don't have anything to do with him." Pilate is sitting there on the throne, and he says, "Okay, which will it be, Barabbas or Jesus?" And much to his dismay, the crowd begins to chant, "We want Barabbas! We want Barabbas! Away with the man! Away with Jesus! We want Barabbas!" Pilate says, "Well, what shall I do with this man who's called Jesus?" Then, to his dismay, with all of one accord, they begin to yell, "Crucify him! Crucify him! Crucify him! Crucify him! Away with him!" Well, Pilate can't believe his ears. He said, "I will scourge him." And he takes him in, and he turns him over to the Roman soldiers, and they beat him. And the Bible simply says they scourge him. But I think the reason that it does is because the term and the idea and the concept was so familiar to whom the writer wrote. We're not so familiar with scourging. Scourging was a terrible punishment. A scourge was a short stake or short handled whip with long strands of rawhide, leather, at the end of which were tied bits of metal, like lead sinkers. Some accounts say that most Roman scourges had two pieces of lead, like lead sinkers, at the end of each strap. Some, the more cruel executioners, would also tie bits of metal in the end of their scourges so they could cut deeper. Many people were killed by scourging. Many people died from it. The Roman soldiers did not have the compunction of the Jewish executioners. The Jews were held to 40 stripes. Remember in the Old Testament law? And they were so important, they were so stringent about it that they would stop at 39 for fear somebody miscounted. But the Romans had no such law. And who's doing the beating? The Roman soldiers evidently think it's quite funny that here this provincial Jew, now so humble looking, so beaten, so bloody, so ridiculous, they think it's funny that this could be called the king. And they began to call him the king of the Jews. They threw a robe on his shoulders. They reached over and saw some bushes over there and said, you know, this guy needs a crown if he's a king. And so they went over there and grabbed a bunch of thorn bushes and wove them together and then jammed it down on his head. And then they bowed the knee down to him and they said, Hail Jesus, King of the Jews! And they put a little stick in his hand, and every once in a while they'd take the stick out and they'd reach up and hit him on the head on that crown of thorns. That's the kind of suffering that Jesus was going through, let alone the ridicule and the mocking. The pain would have been excruciating. Now Pilate calls for Jesus again. Surely the Jews will have compassion when they see that Jesus is such a ridiculous figure, beaten, bloody, standing before them. He's brought out that robe on his shoulders, that crown of thorns on his head. He's brought out to the Jews, and Pilate looks over at Jesus and says, Behold the man. But the crowd who say, Crucify him, crucify him, crucify him. And Pilate says, Why? What has he done? He's not worthy of death. What has he done? The Jews said, He called himself a king. He made himself the Son of God. Pilate takes him back in. He said, Where did you come from, Jesus? Are you the Son of God? Jesus does not answer. Pilate takes him back out and he says, I don't want to crucify him. Why should I crucify him? He said, Because he makes himself a king. And Pilate, if any man makes himself a king, he's not a friend of Caesar's. If you do not put him to death, you are not a friend of Caesar's. Now that hit home. Pilate knew their plan. The Jews would represent Pilate as not standing for Caesar before Caesar. So he gets a basin of water. He takes his hands and he washes his hands in the sight of the people and says, This man, I am free from the blood of this man. You take him and do what you want to do with him. But as far as I'm concerned, he's an innocent man. The Jews began to cry, His blood be on us and on our children's children. Crucify him. Jesus has turned over to the whole band of Roman soldiers. Again, mock him. And finally, they take that crimson robe off his back, and they tied the cross on his shoulders, and he began his way to Golgotha. In Hebrew, the place of the skull. In Latin, Calvary. Carrying his own cross. Evidently, Jesus could not bear the cross. Simon of Cyrene was forced to carry the cross. Then he was taken and roughly thrown against that rough-hewn timber. And a nail, about 8 inches long, about half inch in diameter, normally square in structure, was taken and nailed into the hands of Jesus. One hand was taken across and laid over on the cross tie, and The executioner would feel for the hollow at the wrist. Medical science has shown that to nail in to this part of the palm of the hand would probably strip through the fingers. It was not normally the procedure. Normally it was done at the base of the hand, the wrist, which is anatomically called part of the hand. He felt for the notch or for that hole and then took the nail and put it there and then drove it into that timber. My friends, it's time we start thinking about it. It's time we started remembering what Jesus went through on the cross for us. And then they put the other nail in that hand and drove it in to the tithe. Then when they would tack the titulus, which was the title above his head, Jesus Christ, the King of the Jews. And then they got down from the ladder and went around. The executioner went down and took his feet, pulled one foot down and the other one on top of it, and took that big spike and drove it through his feet. Jesus is now crucified. Crucifixion is a terrible death. It's a death which cannot be really described adequately. It's a death literally of suffocation. Because after a long period of time, the nerves and the muscles cramp to the extent that they can no longer function. 6 hours. We sing the song, Writhing in Anguish and Pain, and we sing it so lightly. Up and down for 6 hours on that rough-hewn lumber with a completely raw and ribboned back. Jesus lived, and Jesus died. While he's on the cross, he's offered wine and myrrh and so forth. He refuses to accept it. And perhaps either while they were nailing him on the cross or after they had just finished, he looked down at those soldiers who were gambling on his garments and said, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. He would look over and say to the thief, Verily, verily, today shalt thou be with me in paradise. He would look at the woman who was his mother, who's standing there with a young disciple, and say, Or woman, behold thy son. Son, behold thy mother. He would cry out in anguish of spirit and say, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? He would cry after hours of agonizing pain, lack of water and moisture, loss of blood, the serum of his blood, the blood thickening and becoming thicker and thicker so that the heart becomes harder and harder and more difficult to pump the blood, would cry, I thirst. Toward the end of his hours on the cross, he would say, It is finished. And say, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. What do you see when you survey the cross? Do you see your sin that put him there? When you look around, do you see the sins of the world that put Jesus on the cross? When I survey the cross, I think about my sin that put Jesus on there. When I survey the cross, I think about my need and what God has done in His love for me. When I think about the cross, I think of the significance of all the things we do in the name of Christ. That how those things become significant and have no meaning without it. Those on that day when they surveyed the cross, the innocent or the bystanders would cry out in ridicule and say, Come down off of the cross, Jesus. You claim to be the Christ. You claim to be the Son of God. And surely if you have that power, use it and come down, and then we'll believe. The priests, when they looked at the cross, saw only a body to get down. So we've got to get him off the cross before the Sabbath day comes. You know, you can't have a dead body hanging on the cross. Go out there and break their legs. They broke the legs of the two thieves, but Jesus was already dead in fulfillment of prophecy. The soldiers saw only some garments to get, something to get out of it. Mary saw her son, in whom she saw so much promise, die an agonizing death. And God looked down from heaven and saw His begotten Son, His beloved Son, dying on a cross for people who did not care. Do you care? Jesus died for you on the cross of Calvary. Have you accepted His death? Have you symbolized His death and your obedience to the gospel? Repenting, dying to sin, being baptized to be raised through the power of God to walk in newness of life? Have you crucified Him afresh and put Him to an open shame with the life that you live as a Christian? My friends, don't crucify Him again. Once is enough. Yes, Jesus died, but God raised Him up that we might have life. Do you have life? If you've not obeyed the gospel, you don't have life as God has promised. If you've gone astray, you don't have life now.